Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast on a very busy Monday. I am I'm Charlie Sykes. We're looking at the stock market. We're closer to a trade war. I have a piece up basically saying, hey, happy Monday. Everything is worse. And I figured that over the weekend, I would just throw out some hot takes, cheap shots, and deep thoughts, including why so many pundits are melting down, why Democrats are so bad at politics, and why bad things keep happening to Charlie Kirk's organization. I also have a sort of a modest suggestion for naming our time. We're not the Gilded Age. How about the Grifted Age? We won't get into all of that. So joining me on the podcast today, we're going to go heavy on trade wars. Ben White, chief economist, chief economic correspondent for Politico, and a columnist for Morning Money, and the Bulwark's own Andrew Egger. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Charlie.
Thank you.
So you guys watch Game of Thrones last night?
I feel like I'm the only American who doesn't.
It's you and me both. I'm a conscientious objector to that sort of lowbrow entertainment, Charlie.
I'm just puzzled this morning why there's not more commentary about the clear 9/11 / Nagasaki references at the end. I mean, I was expecting it to be sort of, you know, at an intensity level of 8 out of 10. It turned out to be 15. But you know, when the towers are falling and Arya is running, it's like, oh my God, you've turned one of the great heroines of the show into basically a terrorist. But since you guys are not into it, I'm not going to dwell on that. But you know, these are the things that we are obsessed about. But let's jump right into the trade war, which is very, very easy and easy to win. And before we get into what's happening today, I just want to play this cut from Fox News yesterday morning, where Larry Kudlow, who I'm going to, you know, throw him the bone of saying that he knows better, but he's on with Chris Wallace being asked this fundamental question, who actually pays these tariffs and who gets hurt? So here's a sort of an extended clip from that exchange.
President Trump had to say this week,
our country can take in $120 billion a year in tariffs, paid for mostly by China, by the way, not by us. A lot of people try and steer it in a different direction. It's really paid, ultimately, it's paid for largely by China.
But Larry, that isn't true. It's not China that pays tariffs. It's the American importers, the American companies that pay what in effect is a tax increase and oftentimes passes it on to U.S. consumers.
Fair enough. In fact, both sides will pay. Both sides will pay in these things. And, of course, it depends.
If it's a tariff on goods coming into the country, the Chinese aren't paying.
No, but the Chinese will suffer GDP losses and so forth with respect to a diminishing export market and goods that they may need for their own
I understand that, but the president says China pays the tariffs. They may suffer consequences, but it's U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers who pay, correct?
Yes, to some extent. I mean, yeah, I don't disagree with that. Again, both sides will suffer on this.
Hey, so let's start with the basics here, gentlemen. Ben, first of all, you know, when we're done hitting our heads on the desk, who pays tariffs?
I got to tell you, Charlie, I can't hit my head on the desk anymore because I think I've concussed myself enough times over this that it's not recommended. But American businesses and consumers pay the tariffs. There's been academic work done on this since the tariffs went into effect, and they show about 100% pass through to U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers. So Trump is wrong about it. Kudlow, I thought, you know, at least nodded in the direction of reality and, you know, basic economics, while not completely undermining what Trump has said. But he did not contest Wallace's point that, you know, these are taxes on American businesses and consumers, and then pivoted to, well, China also suffers. And China does suffer long term in a trade war. But as of now, the tariffs we've put on some $200 billion plus in Chinese exports to the U.S., all of those costs have been borne by first the importing companies and then later passed on to consumers. And if we were to go to 25% tariffs on $550 billion, everything that China exports to the United States, that would get passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices. So there just isn't any evidence yet that China is bearing the brunt of this. Long term, you know, they could wind up paying, but they're not right now.
Kudlow's point was, of course, also this would hurt the Chinese economy. And of course, this morning, Chinese announced tariffs on $60 billion in U.S. goods. And of course, this spooked the financial market. So, Ben, the markets, explain to me what they were expecting. I mean, my understanding was that up until last week, they were expecting that this would be resolved, that nobody would go for a full trade war. Then, of course, things fell apart, but they were sort of cool with it on Friday. What makes today different?
Yeah, as we're talking, and who knows where these things wind up, we've had a number of sell-offs that kind of petered out and then buyers returned. But I mean, I think what's different, A, is the Chinese retaliation is real now. And I think it is finally dawning on a lot of investors that this deal that they were expecting and indeed fully counting on has basically fallen apart at this point. The Chinese backtracked, Trump got mad, nobody is talking right now. And I think there still is in the back of everybody's mind on Wall Street a belief that ultimately a trade war, a full trade war, would be so bad for both sides that it will be avoided. But right now the news flow is all bad, so markets are generally selling off. But they're not selling off in such a crazy way that I think it's, you know, there's no longer a belief that there's going to be a deal. I think that belief still exists. You'd see a much bigger capitulation if we went full-scale trade war.
And yet, if you take the president's Twitter feed seriously, which I'm not sure we should, it seems like he's made a pivot from saying that the tariffs are just a tactic to get to a trade war to essentially embracing them as a good in and of themselves. And Andrew, you had a really good piece over the weekend that Trump drops the fig leaf on trade. His advisors and his defenders have been going out saying, look, you know, this is just part of a tactic. We're going to get to zero tariffs. We're going to be able to get a better deal. And then over the last few days, the president has been tweeting about how great tariffs are in and of themselves.
Right. Well, that's always been sort of the line from the free traders in the White House, Kudlow and his like, which is, you know, a similar thing to what we've seen from other members of the Trump administration. As opposed to say on foreign policy, where President Trump has these sort of isolationist nationalist instincts of America first, but then you'll have his generals go out and say, well, America first doesn't mean America alone. They're sort of trying to tweak things around, and we've seen a similar thing on this trade stuff with guys like Kudlow basically saying, look, yes, the tariffs look bad now. It looks protectionist now. But this is actually in pursuit of a long term agenda of free trade. We're just trying to get China to play along nicely with trade. The problem with that is that there's been no indication ever that that's what the president himself believes. And he's the one who, you know, ultimately is pulling the trigger on these sorts of things. If it were Larry Kudlow and his allies in the administration who were setting the rough course of this policy, we wouldn't be diving deeper and deeper into this trade war. We would be, you know, finding a way to paper over it if it had ever been launched at all. But the problem, as we see, is that the guy who is ultimately setting the course, Donald Trump, is just purely operating in this fantasy land, like you got into a minute ago, Ben, where he just thinks, you know, the more tariffs we put on, the more money just flows for free into the U.S. Treasury for us to sort of do with as we please. I mean, he's tweeted things to that effect, several times over the past week, and it's consistent with things he's said before. The sort of optimistic line that you were talking about before, where businesses are just sort of assuming, well, you know, it's not going to get too crazy. It couldn't get too crazy because at a certain point people in the White House will start to see that the trade-offs are too drastic. I mean, I agree that that's, you know, a reasonable thing to believe. My only wonder, I guess, my concern is that, you know, President Trump has not shown really any inclination that he's ready to sort of let these facts that we talk about permeate his own thinking on this issue. And if he just, you know, continues to believe all evidence to the contrary, the more tariffs, the better, then it's really hard to see where that exit ramp comes in.
So, Ben, one way you get into a war, either a hot war or a trade war, is by miscalculation. And there were some suggestions last week that the Chinese had been paying very, very close attention to what Trump was saying, and they were misreading or potentially misreading some of the signals. So, for example, the Wall Street Journal was suggesting that when they were listening to Trump talk about the Fed and why he wanted the Fed to drop interest rates, they saw that as a sign of weakness. and therefore change some of their negotiating strategies? And I guess, first of all, do you think that that's accurate? Do you think that that's one of the things that, led us up to the moment we're at here?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, I think they were watching a couple of things. They were watching his commentary on the Fed and read that as, okay, Trump's worried about the U.S. economy slowing down so we can, you know, get a better deal out of him and not capitulate on some of these things because he's not going to risk, you know, tanking the U.S. economy and markets. And yeah, I think they got that wrong. I think they were also watching, you know, all the Mueller stuff very closely and the release of the report, the aftermath of that, thinking maybe Trump has significant near-term political problems and we can kind of wait him out. Either, you know, something winds up taking him out of office now, or, you know, he's significantly weakened for 2020 that we can capitalize on that and deal with the next guy. So when Trump says that, I think there's some truth to that on the Chinese side, that they were watching those things. And I do think they got pretty much all of that wrong. I mean, there's no indication that Trump is going anywhere anytime soon, and he's got, you know, pretty solid reelection prospects. So yeah, I think there's truth to all of that and truth to the fact that the Chinese just got it wrong. I mean, the existential question here for Trump is kind of Trump the Dow man versus Trump the tariff man. I mean, he cares deeply about what the markets are doing, and this is not enough yet. You know, we're still over 25,000. We're still up for the year. But if it gets a whole lot worse and you're down a couple thousand points, then you get to the point where the Dow man might come out and kill the tariff man. But we're not at that point yet.
Yeah, that's what makes this so interesting, because the markets seem to, at least sort of in the back of their mind, as you point out, assume that both sides will make the rational decision, that it is not in the interest of the American economy or in the interest of the Chinese economy to go ahead with this trade war. But that's where the miscalculations come in, that these things can take on a dynamo, you know, a dynamic of their own. And the president, you know, the president, let's just say, has not shown himself to be disciplined in the messaging or aware of the collateral damage of some of the things he says. So it's certainly possible to imagine that you have a spiraling series of events that lead to something that would be not the rational outcome of this dispute.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, a lot of wars are kind of started by accident for weird reasons, and you think rational actors are going to you know, win the day, and it just doesn't always happen. And we're now in a situation where this thing could spiral out of control and then take on a life of its own. And it's not like markets aren't looking for reasons to be skeptical about the path of the U.S. economy. I mean, you know, we grew well in the first quarter, remains to be seen how the rest of the year goes, but we're, you know, way long at the end of a long expansion, and everybody on Wall Street talks about when the next recession is coming and what could cause it. And this is a thing that could do it if it spirals out of control. So to assume, as Wall Street has for a long time, I think wrongly, that rational actors will see their long-term best economic interests and come to the table and have a kumbaya moment and make a deal is just, you know, wrong and stupid and not necessarily going to happen. And this thing could get a whole lot worse in ways that we don't fully understand at this point. You know, the Chinese do not want to be seen as caving to Trump. Trump certainly politically doesn't want to be seen as giving in to the Chinese. There's lots of political dynamics on both sides that could make this thing blow up. I mean, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but to assume it doesn't is probably folly.
Yeah, I want to ask you, Andrew, about what one of the president's tweets over the weekend. He said tariffs will bring in far more wealth to our country than even a phenomenal deal of the traditional kind. Also, much easier and quicker to do. Our farmers will do better, faster, and starving nations can now be helped. Waivers on some products will be granted to go to new source. But also, if we brought $15 billion of agriculture from our farmers, far more than China buys now, we would have more than $85 billion left over for new infrastructure, healthcare, or anything else. China would greatly slow down, and we would automatically speed up. Now, okay, I'm not an economist, but that makes my head hurt. But also, you suggested that these were glib, and then sort of suggested they were kind of socialist-y promises.
Wait, I mean, yeah, I mean, at least in terms of the rhetoric, I mean, it is a lot of sort of just tossing around of promises about what America's going to do, you know, with this money it generates from these tariffs in the Treasury. Although, as we've discussed, I mean, that even that is sort of a fantasy. I mean, so the big question is to what degree these are actually the lines that are informing Trump's strategy about, you know, what we're going to do, and to what degree he's just sort of trying to strike the maximally confident posture in these negotiations with China. I mean, you can see, you know, a situation either way. It isn't as though the president has never sort of backed off one of these trade demands. I mean, after posturing about NAFTA, for instance, for years, they basically renegotiated that deal to be largely the same as it was before, because Trump realized he couldn't get a better one and needed that deal. And then he just sort of, you know, went on to just pretend that they had made, like, you know, extracted tons and tons and tons of concessions and just sort of willed that deal into existence sort of in his own fantasia. But the question is whether, you know, that's the kind of thing that he's doing, whether he's just sort of trying to use the most confident possible rhetoric while sort of behind the scenes sort of furtively looking around for some sort of exit strategy. The danger, and I mean, we can't discount the possibility, is that these fantastical, you know, completely divorced from reality things that he's saying are actually what he believes about tariffs. That he actually thinks that he has, you know, China in a bind, and that the only reason why China had him in a bind before is because, you know, China's leaders used to be way smarter than our previous dumb leaders in Trump's parlance, and that now it's the other way around, that Trump's the smartest guy in the room. He's going to get his deal, and he's confident, you know, doubling down and doubling down and doubling down until he finally gets there.
So Ben, did I catch what you said before, or did I mishear when you said you thought that Trump had pretty solid prospects for reelection?
Yeah, I do think that. I mean, if you look at where the economy is and where wages are, I mean, traditionally, candidates, particularly incumbent candidates who have these kind of economies, win re-election, and they win it fairly easily. Now, Trump is not a traditional incumbent president, and, you know, has a lot of negatives and a lot of things that, you know, argue against an easy re-election. But I would start from the base case that he is a sitting president with a good economy, and that tends to mean re-election. So, yeah, I do think his prospects, and I've written this, are better than a lot of Democrats think or resistance people think, that, you know, they're just going to roll over him in 2020 with anybody they put up there. I don't think that's true, but it's certainly not going to be helpful to him for re-election if we are engaged in a, you know, trade war with China. And then, you know, on the NAFTA-USMCA point, you know, he did kind of capitulate, and USMCA is not that different from NAFTA, although it does include some better stuff that was initially in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But that's not done yet, and Congress hasn't approved that and might not approve that. So the question is, what does he do then? Does he let NAFTA stay in place, or go back to his threats of just dumping NAFTA and going back to a pre-NAFTA world? So another risk for his reelection if he does that. And this is a subject for another podcast, but you've got all the fiscal deadlines coming up.
Well, I agree with you on this, but you're still in the camp of it's the economy, stupid. So what about the argument that we've moved into a different phase where cultural identity issues are more important than pocketbook issues, that to a certain extent Trump is the outlier, that if in fact the economy really was driving our politics, then Trump, given the state of the economy, should be much higher than what he is right now? I mean, his numbers just do not budge. They're, you know, 41, 42, 43%, and nothing seems to move them up or down. And some other president with a 25,000 Dow, the kind of growth unemployment numbers that he's enjoying, should be much, much higher. So you're still going for the economy stupid.
Well, you know, I'm sort of the economy stupid with a big asterisk, you know, that I do agree with the idea that it's not the driver that it once was or might be if we're talking about President Mitt Romney right now or somebody else who's more a traditional Republican and does not polarize in the extreme way that Trump does. And that's why his numbers don't budge, even if he has 58% approval on the economy. People who don't like him really don't like him. And, you know, swing voters, moderates, whatever, are turned off by, you know, all of the noise and all of the way he dominates our daily life and, you know, all the identity politics stuff. It definitely, we've moved beyond it just being the economy. But I do think it still matters if an incumbent is running with a good economy. It gives him a shot at, you know, reelection that he might not have if we were headed towards recession. So I don't think it's purely the economy that drives our politics now, or, you know, will drive the reelection prospects for Trump. But I do think it kind of puts a floor under where he is and puts him in a stronger position, obviously, than he otherwise would be.
If I could just add one thing to that, I am pretty sympathetic to the, you know, economy stupid argument as well, specifically for Trump's reelection prospects. And at least sort of in my way of thinking, there's perhaps a difference between sort of how people assess, you know, his performance on a day-to-day basis and sort of like the lived reality of the Trump presidency, where, you know, they're mad about this, that, or the other outrageous thing that he did, and, you know, this cruelty or that bigoted remark or what have you. But you know, when it actually comes to, you know, going into a voting booth and pulling a lever one way or the other, people might sort of be able to abstract from that a little bit and actually sort of focus on issues like, you know, like the economy, where it is more just a question of pure interest. Like, do I think that this guy's been good for my pocketbook or not? So I don't know whether that to what degree that will, you know, be on people's minds in a year. But I do think you certainly don't want to undersell the fact that he is presiding over a strong economy. There's a reason why he, you know, goes to that talking point every time he wants to talk. I mean, it used to be a couple of years ago the big thing was, you know, cutting regulations and beating ISIS and things like that. And now you hardly ever hear about anything at all, except, you know, strongest economy, really low unemployment, those sorts of things. They're leading with that really hard.
You know, I'm torn, Ben, and I want to get your take on this, because I saw you tweeted about Joe Biden. I'm torn between shaking my head over how bad Democrats are at politics and what a bubble they are in, that they've sort of convinced that – I have a piece up today talking about how they spend their time in a political holodeck where they get to indulge their fantasies, that their most extreme ideas are going to be embraced by people, that they are beautiful and loved, and, you know, that, you know, gosh darn, people really, really like us, and they have movies and they have TV shows that constantly convince them how cool they are. And if you look at Twitter, you get this really sort of alternative reality – versus the fact that these numbers are coming in from places like South Carolina showing that the most, I guess, more reasonable candidate, Joe Biden, is not just leading, but is just blowing the field away. So I you know, my theory of 2020 is it's the Democrats to lose, despite what we've been saying about the economy, which of course is true. It's theirs to lose. And they seem very anxious to do so by moving to the left. And yet, this Biden phenomenon, is this thing for real, Ben?
Yeah, it is for real. I mean, you can't discount the numbers, with the caveat that, you know, it's super early. And plenty of people have big leads early on and faded. But I do think it's real. And I do think it reflects the idea that, you know, there is sort of the woke Democratic Party that lives on Twitter and that lives to some extent, you know, in left-wing media, and there are lots of litmus tests for what you have to say and have to believe and have to do to, you know, win over that very loud but relatively small part of the Democratic Party. And then there's the broad rest of it, which I think, you know, just wants to win in 2020, would be happy with somebody like Biden, who is not going to be a flame-throwing leftist and not promise, you know, free college for everybody and free Medicare for everybody and, you know, do all of that stuff. But who is viewed as, you know, a generally reasonable alternative to Trump, who's not going to embarrass anybody on a daily basis. Although it's Biden, so maybe he does embarrass him, but for the most part.
He'll embarrass you in a fun way, not in a sort of soul-crushing way.
Right. So I do think it's exposed this idea that there is, you know, this massive leftward shift in the Democratic Party that I don't think necessarily exists more broadly in a lot of these states that you've talked about, you know, South Carolina, Florida, right, where it's just everybody's butt.
Well, the question, of course, is it is a very, very long campaign. Joe Biden is still Joe Biden. You know, before this, we would have identified him as one of the, you know, the top 10, you know, gaffe-prone politicians in America. And you wonder how many of these ideological rings he has to kiss between now and the election. The level of intolerance for dissent really does kind of remind me of some of the litmus tests that the Republicans had a few years ago. But it's hard to imagine that this is a party that would react to a sister soldier moment the way they reacted, say, back in 1992 when Bill Clinton was prepared to be, you know, somewhat politically independent on that stuff. Like, I can't imagine Joe Biden pulling that off and it not blowing up. So I guess that's the question, is, you know, how many things does he have to do, you know, between now and then, that the Republicans will be able to very effectively weaponize?
I don't think that many, to be honest with you. Like, I think they've been smart so far in early days, but, you know, and not engaging on a lot of these topics. I mean, he's going to have to engage on all of them by the end, but I think he can probably steer a fairly safe middle ground while, you know, saying, okay, I believe in trade, but we need to protect workers and the environment. And I believe in expanding healthcare, but not necessarily Medicare for all. Like, I think he can walk all of those lines and probably emerge all right, as, you know, you've got plenty of people who beat themselves up on the left, Warren and Sanders and the rest, and Biden can occupy that other lane pretty successfully. And no early polls suggest he has to do it otherwise. So I don't think this idea that he's got to attack hard left and then expose himself to, you know, socialist charges is right, or we have evidence of that yet.
Well, so how are the Democrats going to handle this trade war with China, given the fact that many of them have been trade hawks up until now? You know, it is the Republicans who had been at one point in the distant past, or actually 5 minutes ago, free traders. But, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party has never had any problem with this. So how are they going to respond to Trump?
Yeah, it's complicated for them. I mean, particularly for Biden. But I mean, you saw Kamala Harris over the weekend say she would have opposed NAFTA. I mean, the general position that they're in is, you know, they generally agree with some of the thrust of what Trump is saying, that, you know, these trade deals have hurt workers, and obviously they're the party of labor unions, and have to kind of pledge fealty to that, while at the same time saying, you know, I would take a different approach, some sort of multilateral approach, and not do it the way Trump has done it, and what he's doing isn't working. But, you know, for the most part, they're aligned with Trump. I mean, Chuck Schumer has basically endorsed a lot of what Trump has done with China in broad terms. I think the toughest road is for Biden, who has, you know, a career as a free trader, somebody who supported permanent, you know, normal trade relations with China, who in the Obama administration was, you know, pro-TPP. He's got to figure out a way to talk about this that doesn't alienate the left and labor, while also painting some sort of future path on trade that, you know, is both embraces the idea that in the long term, more freer trade is good for workers and lifts nations out of poverty. But, you know, we also have to do all this stuff to protect workers in the industrial Midwest. I don't know exactly how he figures that out, but in terms of the list of challenges that Biden has, at least in my world, that's a big one.
And I do think it's worth saying that, you know, Trump has left a relatively wide lane for Democrats to figure out that space where they're saying, you know, I agree very broadly on sort of a philosophical level with these sorts of trade actions, but I'm going to execute far better than Trump did. Because part of the problem with Trump is not just that he's you know, open to trade wars, but that, you know, tactically it's been difficult because he's opened so many fronts at once. He wants them all to be sort of bilateral deals between us and some other country. So he's tossing out all of the multilateral ones and trying to sort of go mano a mano with each individual world leader, and sort of in a way that, you know, things have sort of stalled out. So I do think it's, you know, that's not a, it's not an incomprehensible place for Democrats to go to basically say, I'll just do what Trump's trying to do, but better.
Well, actually,
I think that's the whole point.
Yeah. And Ben, I think you addressed this before. It does sound like Trump, or at least some parts of Trump world, have convinced themselves that this trade war is good politics. And I think Steve Bannon was quoted over the weekend as saying, now politics is driving all of this, so that he can say, I am taking a tough line with China. I am attacking China. I cannot be accused of caving in or being weak. This is another one of my promises kept. And I guess that goes to this formula of whether or not we're in this war for the long haul. If Donald Trump thinks that this is the best political position for him, then he's going to ride it. And of course, you point out that he's going to ride that until the stock market, the bottom falls out of the stock market, and then that's going to change his calculation. But it does seem for the moment that he thinks that there's a political advantage to doing what he's doing right now. And we know that that's what drives decision making in this particular White House.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is a very complicated question to unpack, but I think that it's, you know, it's probably true that there's political benefit to being tough on China. And Bannon's not wrong about that. And he can't cave now and capitulate now and not be seen as politically weak. And he did promise to, you know, take on China in a way that no previous U.S. president or recent U.S. president has done. But you know, it will get to the point where the collateral damage of it outweighs that, that the damage to the economy and to markets are so undermining of his chances at reelection that, you know, he'll be forced into making some kind of a deal. It just has to be enough of a deal with enough concessions from the Chinese that he can sell it as, you know, I did what I promised to do, and we've made these pieces of progress with the Chinese. He thought he was close to that point in the recent negotiations, and then it fell apart, and they backed off. And so now he's got to be belligerent and tough again, with the hope that the result is, you know, a couple of months down the road, enough damage has been done to the Chinese economy and markets that say, okay, we'll give you back these few things we agreed to, and make the deal. So I think he can be tough, has to be tough on China, and Bannon's not wrong about that politically, but it ultimately has to lead to an actual deal. Or the politics and the economic ramifications will be, you know, too awful for him to deal with.
Ben White, Andrew Egger, thank you so much for joining me today on this Monday in the Bulwark podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks for
having
us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.